This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington, and coming up on Africa News Tonight.
The Prime Minister arrived this morning at Washington, D.C., Dallas International Airport, and he was accompanied by the leaders of regional states of Ethiopia, like Oromia, which is the largest region in the country, and the second largest, Amhara region president as well. And the foreign minister was with him.
That's VOA Solomon Abate speaking on the arrival of Ethiopian Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed. We'll have the full story coming up. Also, the annual three-day meeting of BRICS and Association of Five Major Emerging Economies ends tomorrow in Pretoria. Tensions between herders and farmers have burst into violence in Nigeria, with more than 1,300 dead so far. And at least 15 senators and 33 House of Representatives members defect from Nigeria's ruling All Progressives Congress. We'll have these stories and more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Our top story, Ethiopian Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed arrived in Washington this morning and will be meeting with religious leaders this afternoon. He is making his first U.S. visit after instituting a series of transformative reforms in his homeland. Earlier this year, Ethiopia faced widespread unrest and violent protest against a government that appeared unresponsive and entrenched. In less than 4 months in office, Abiy has led a dramatic turnaround. Sweeping reforms have quelled dissent, boosted civil liberties, and begun to heal wounds from decades of ethnic tension and marginalization. And he took the lead in ending the bloody border war with Eritrea. My colleague Solomon Abate is covering the prime minister's visit. He spoke with me about his arrival and what his plans are in the U.S.
The prime minister arrived this morning at Washington, D.C., Dallas International Airport, and he was accompanied by the leaders of regional states of Ethiopia, like Oromia, which is the largest region in the country, and the second largest, Amhara region president as well. And the foreign minister was with him. So the delegation was quite big, but we were not able to see the prime minister at the airport due to some security reasons, I think. He is now at the Watergate Hotel, and he's preparing to meet with religious leaders. That would be his first meeting in his six-day visit in the United States.
What is the purpose of his visit with the religious leaders?
There was a problem in the Ethiopian Orthodox Church, which is one of the main religious groups in the country. They have been trying to reconcile their differences and come to one synod. So they have been working until to date to resolve those problems among themselves. And they are saying, in fact, there are rumors that they have already resolved the problems, and they were waiting the arrival of the prime minister to announce their peace agreement. We are expecting on this meeting, we will have the news about the reconciliation of these two rival groups.
Also, we know that he will be meeting with the diaspora community in Washington, D.C. So what is the expectation from this meeting?
Well, as you know, probably, Kim, this is a very popular leader of Ethiopia. In fact, his popularity is unprecedented in the political history of the country. He has overwhelming support within the country, and he has big support in the diaspora community as well. So he is trying to galvanize support behind him. And he earlier said, and the organizing committee of his trip to the United States announced that peace travel is aimed to talk to the Ethiopian diaspora community, specifically in North America, mainly in the United States. So come Saturday, he will have a big gathering, a big rally, where some 25 to 40,000 Ethiopians and Ethiopian Americans would be gathering to hear from him. He would deliver speech on that meeting. And he wants, you know, the diaspora community to have part in all activities back in the country, in political area, in economic area, in social activities. And he is appealing to Ethiopians abroad from this forum.
What are some other groups that the prime minister will be speaking with on his trip here?
He's trip is full of different programs, Kim. He will be talking to Ethiopian business community, in fact, in the United States. He will be talking to leaders of political parties, activists, and he will have another large meeting on Saturday with various think tank leaders of the communities. So he will have a quite busy weekend, and he will be traveling to Los Angeles to attend same gathering, same big rally in Los Angeles. About more than 20,000 Ethiopian Americans are being expected, you know, to attend that meeting. And on Monday, he will fly to Minnesota. He will attend another gathering in Minneapolis. Some 15,000 to 20,000 Ethiopians are expected to be there as well.
That's VOA's Solomon Abate speaking with me from the Watergate Hotel in Washington, D.C. The South Sudan government signed a power-sharing agreement with some parties meeting in Khartoum last night. The South Sudan Opposition Alliance and the former detainees refused to sign the deal, saying they do not agree with several of its provisions. At the signing ceremony, the Sudanese Foreign Minister Al-Diri Diri Mohammed Ahmed said power-sharing issues at the state level remain unresolved. He says mediators will continue to engage the parties to try to reach a consensus. Michael Atit reports for VOA from Khartoum.
The 11-page deal describes the composition of presidency, a cabinet of 35 ministers, 10 deputy ministers, and National Assembly during the transitional period. Under the agreement, Salva Kiir will continue as president, SPLM-IO chairman Riek Machar will resume his post as first vice president, and four vice presidents will be appointed, including at least one woman. The deal stipulates that, apart from first vice president, there shall be no hierarchy among the vice presidents. The first vice president and vice presidents will be tasked with overseeing specific cabinet clusters, which include governance, economy, service delivery, infrastructure, as well as gender and youth clusters. Representatives of Transitional Government of the National Unity, the SPLM-IO, other political parties, civil society organizations, and refugees signed the document along with Sudanese Foreign Minister Al-Dirdiri Muhammad Ahmed, who signed as a guarantor of the deal. Ahmed says the parties did not agree on the number of states or on their boundaries. He says a 15-member commission comprised of representatives from the various parties will be formed to hammer out those issues.
If it fails, then a referendum will be conducted by and before the end of the last months of the pre-transition period. That is within a period of 5 months. That referendum is supposed to determine finally the issue of boundaries and numbers of states of South Sudan.
Alikaya Aligo Samson, who heads the Policy Institute concerned South Sudanese, says holding a referendum during the pre-transitional period to determine the number of states could cause tension and might even break the deal.
That is a sensitive area or period for the transformation, where we are facing the challenge of confidence building. To bring a very decisive and critical issue like that that can divide the society into two, therefore also we are risking with the peace process.
Aligo says, rather than leaving the matter up to a referendum, the parties should strive to resolve it through consensus in order to avoid taking the country back into war. Information Minister Michael Makuei is advising the South Sudanese Opposition Alliance and the former detainees to reconsider their position or risk being left out of the peace process.
Those who have not signed are insignificant, they have no effect, and we will continue without them if they don't join us. We are implementing the agreement in letter and spirit.
Sarah Nyanyas, who initialed the document on behalf of the South Sudanese refugees, is urging the country's leaders to stop bickering over positions and sign a final peace agreement. She says refugees need to come home.
Whoever is behind and take pleasure in seeing the innocent South Sudanese suffer, I would beg you, please, 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 I mean once in a lifetime, give South Sudanese peace. Let South Sudanese become stable. Let our women and children get back home. Let their bones not be in different countries. For God's sake, let our elders go back home and rest in peace in our land and not in a strange land.
Minister Ahmed praised the parties that signed the deal.
What you have witnessed just today is just an example of what we went through over the previous 19 days. And normally, we continue negotiating those issues all along until the small hours of the day. So those issues were by no means easy. And the agreement that we have arrived on them is not at all an achievement that could have been done without this sacrifice.
Ahmed says the mediators will continue to engage the parties on the remaining issues before handing over the next round of negotiations to Kenya. For VOA News, I am Michael Atit in Khartoum, Sudan.
The annual three-day meeting of BRICS, an association of five major emerging economies, ends tomorrow in Pretoria. The group includes Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa. It started in 2009 as a relatively informal gathering of ministers eager to swap ideas and further their nation's shared economic interest. It has evolved into a prominent body capable of exerting international economic influence. John Campbell, a former U.S. ambassador to Nigeria, is the leading Africa foreign policy expert at the Council on Foreign Relations. VOA's Adam Phillips spoke with him about BRICS.
Between them, the total population of BRICS member states represent nearly 3.5 billion people, or over 40% of the world's population. All have what are considered developing or emerging economies. Still,
if you look at the BRICS, they have really very little in common.
John Campbell is the Ralph Bunche Senior Fellow for Africa Policy Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. He is also former U.S. Ambassador to Nigeria.
You have three democracies, Brazil, India, and South Africa, but you also have China and Russia. In terms of size of economies, of course, the Chinese is far greater than any of the others. More than a billion Chinese, as opposed to 60 million South Africans. What kind of internal coherence can they have over time? And yet, BRICS seems to be a useful instrument for the BRICS heads of state, so it endures.
Campbell says BRICS is an opportunity for these large economies, which historically have not been big players on the international stage, to stand together with respect to the global status quo.
For example, it is expected at this meeting of the BRICS heads of state, there'll be support for the Paris Agreement on climate change. The same is true with the emphasis on the necessity for free trade. Both of these, of course, are hot issues given the approach of the Trump administration. After all, an increased tariffs at the end of the day is probably going to affect them. And after all, the largest BRICS country is China.
At the same time, Campbell expects BRICS to put pressure on the European Union and on other multilateral institutions to recognize the changing balance of global economic and political power.
For example, since 2000, the share of global GDP held by emerging economies has doubled from 20% to over 40%. And BRICS is acutely aware of that reality. The South Africans have invited to this BRICS meeting no less than 13 other states, most of which are African. They'll all be there, they'll all be in a room, they'll all be meeting, and they'll all be talking.
Once again, South Africa, which is hosting this year's summit, is playing its own very specific game. In some previous years, former President Jacob Zuma touted BRICS as an alternative to his country's traditional economic ties to Europe. Zuma did this, says Campbell, mainly to shore up domestic political support.
And of course, it was during Jacob Zuma's administration that China became, though only temporarily, South Africa's largest trading partner.
In contrast, Zuma's successor, Cyril Ramaphosa, has reasserted the importance of South Africa's traditional trade relationship with the West.
So that the, as it were, political dimension of BRICS, I think, will be somewhat less important for him. But the fact that he is hosting BRICS and there are going to be all those heads of state in Pretoria, increases the profile of South Africa, but also Cyril Ramaphosa as the president of South Africa. So from that perspective, this meeting is highly useful for him.
Just which specific policy changes will come of the three-day BRICS summit that ends Friday is not clear. Given the unorthodox structure and history of the conference, Africa watchers might be surprised. To quote Ambassador John Campbell of the Council on Foreign Relations, at the 10-year mark, the most remarkable thing about BRICS is that it's still there. Adam Phillips, VOA News, New York.
Tensions between herders and farmers have burst into violence in Nigeria, with more than 1,300 dead so far this year. The results have been disruptions in food production, higher prices, and the possibility that the country's latest security threat could affect next year's presidential election. The International Crisis Group released a new report today. My colleague Paul Alexander spoke with E.J. Hogendorn, ICG's Deputy Program Director for Africa, about the violence and recommendations on dealing with it.
Well, the situation in Nigeria is very, very worrisome. We actually put out a first report on farmer-herder conflict last year where we described what was happening, and the situation has escalated to such a degree that we felt compelled to put out a second report. Just this year, something on the order of 1,300 people have died in farmer-herder violence. That fighting is now spreading and escalating in intensity. And we fear that things could only get worse as the Nigerian government is approaching elections in February of 2019.
So what are the factors that have led to this bloodshed?
There are a lot of factors, but the main ones that we focus on is that the increase in population in Nigeria has put a lot of pressure on land, and so farmers and herders are struggling over access to a finite resource, being both grazing land and water. Obviously, the carrying capacity of the land has also been impacted by climate change and the loss of grazing territory for herders, which is forcing them to move farther south, where there are already well-established farming communities. And then last but not least, there is a social factor, which is that impunity and the fact that the government has so far failed to hold many people accountable for atrocities that have been committed during this conflict is creating a cycle of tit-for-tat killings that's only escalating.
So what are your recommendations to ease the tensions there?
Well, we think there are four things that the government should be focusing on at this current stage. One is they need to bolster security for both farmers and herding communities. That means sending more police and other security forces to these areas where conflict is endemic, and to have them respond much more rapidly when there are reports of impending attacks. Judicially, the government needs to really start holding people who are behind these attacks accountable for the deaths and destruction that has occurred. There's also now in place something called the National Livestock Transformation Plan, which the Nigerian government has devised, which is essentially a plan to gradually move herders from open grazing to more managed ranching style raising of livestock, and we think that that should be implemented as soon as possible and given the resources necessary to make that happen. And last but not least, the government needs to freeze enforcement of very popular but very discriminatory open grazing bans that have been implemented in a number of states in central Nigeria, and then reform that anti-grazing legislation so that it is implemented more gradually in a way that farmers can gradually move from open grazing to this ranching lifestyle.
You mentioned political implications, especially for the February elections. What could be the impact?
Our big concern, of course, is that farmer-herder violence could be utilized by politicians to mobilize voters from specific communities for themselves. And that, of course, raises real concerns about whether this will escalate the violence between the two groups as tensions raise towards February 2019 elections.
That was E.J. Hogendorn, Deputy Program Director for Africa at the International Crisis Group, speaking with VOA's Paul Alexander. While the U.N. High Commissioner for Human Rights, Zayed Raad al-Hussein, is seeking access to Cameroon to verify what he says are alarming reports of horrific abuse by separatists and government forces in the English-speaking Northwest and Southwest regions. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from the High Commissioner's office in Geneva.
The UN Human Rights Office says the situation in Cameroon's English-speaking communities has worsened considerably since protests against what the English speakers see as structural discrimination started 2 years ago. The Anglophones are demanding an end to what they allege is their economic and political marginalization by the country's Francophone majority. The High Commissioner spokeswoman, Ravina Shamdasani, tells VOA what began as protests for greater access to jobs and linguistic equality has gotten out of hand. She says violence by both armed separatists and the government has spiraled out of control.
The violent separatists, these armed groups, are killing people, torching schools, carrying out kidnappings and extortion and all sorts of horrible human rights abuses to try to disrupt the situation. The government's role should be to protect people in such a horrible environment. Instead, the government is employing a heavy-handed response, which is not helping the situation. It is further causing human rights violations.
United Nations figures show more than 21,000 refugees have fled to neighboring countries, while some 160,000 people are internally displaced by the violence, with many reportedly hiding in forests. An army spokesman has rejected charges of abuses by the security forces as rumors. Shamdasani says there's a lot of misinformation and propaganda on both sides. She says the High Commissioner has asked that monitors be allowed to verify allegations of abuse against both security forces and armed separatists. She says the government has rejected this request. Consequently, she says the UN Human Rights Office will have to consider other options to keep tabs on the situation, including remote monitoring. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Please stay tuned to the Sunny Side of Sports coming up at 18:30 UTC. On behalf of our producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Xiaogun Chung, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Africa, I'm James Butte, host of VOA's Daybreak Africa. When news breaks, VOA Africa is there, bringing you the news as it happens. Listen to Daybreak Africa Monday through Friday at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC. And our 5 minute newscast come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.
Hey, sports fans, brighten your day by tuning in to the Sunny Side of Sports, Monday through Friday at 16:30 and 18:30 UTC. Join us on Facebook at facebook.com/VOA Sunny and on Twitter at VOA Sunny Sports. Or check out the blog at blogs.voanews.com/Sunny. It's the Sunny Side of Sports right here on the Voice of America.
VOAAfrica.com.
On VOAAfrica.com, the news updates never stop. Our primary goal is to keep you informed.
VOAAfrica.com, your trusted source for news and information.